The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Please welcome our introducer, Sixers announcer, Mark Zumoff.
Listen, I know you're not supposed to make a lot of noise in the library, but if you want to give it up, if you want to give it up for a young, exciting, surprising, scrappy Sixers team, go right ahead. Here's the drill. No cell phones. I know you're going to have about 30 seconds for flash photography, and that's it. Following the lecture, a book signing is going to take place upstairs in the lobby. And remember that most of the author events here, including this one, will be offered as podcasts. Go to freelibrary.org. And finally, for you tweeters, please do not tweet your location. We also want to tell you that many of the Free Library's programs, services, and resources are made possible only with individual support, which includes after-school programs for kids, as well as tonight's event with the legend himself. If you would like to make a gift to help the library advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity, please visit freelibrary.org. Consider the 60s. Who's old enough here to remember the 60s? That's right. That's what I'm talking about. Well, unfortunately, the 60s are remembered for some other things like race riots and desegregation, and back in the day, NBA basketball was considered something to get us from football to baseball. Well, this is when a renegade league known as the American Basketball Association was born. And this is where we caught a glimpse of the man with the big afro who could fly. By the 70s, he would enter the NBA. He'd become a 76er. And, of course, he dazzled us with his flight, but he actually reached greater heights as a man who touched people of all races, all religions, and all classes. It was his personality, his intelligence, and his class that made us feel good. By the 80s, of course, he would win a title. Remember that, 1983? Exactly. By the 90s, I was the halftime host on Prism, if you could remember that. Mm-hmm. Well, I had the opportunity to interview Michael Jordan. And who was his idol? Julius Erving. A month ago, do you remember LeBron James? He said his idol was Michael Jordan. So the Erving legacy lives on. From the segregated 60s to the 21st century, Julius Erving's impact, I believe, athletically and socially, is greater than anyone who has ever laced them up. His new memoir is about his life on and off the court. In fact, Sports Illustrated says the book is quite an accomplishment, a terrific memoir by a man who is worthy of one. Dr. J is going to be interviewed tonight by Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Joe Giuliano. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the great Julius Erving.
And you thought they forgot about you.
It's all good. It's all good, Joe. It's all good.
Well, thanks, everyone, and thanks for that subdued reception. I'm Joe Giuliano from The Inquirer, and Julius and I go back to 1976 as welcome to Philadelphia press conference at what I think was the Stadium Hilton or Holiday Inn or whatever the heck it was, 10th and Packer. Mm-hmm. October 25th, 1976. Do you remember the first question you were asked?
Where'd you get that bow tie?
Well, you never saw 100 sports writers more quiet in your life. When Julius walked in, you know, we'd all read about him, seen like grainy footage of him, but here he was in person. And after about a 20-second delay, which in a room of 100 people is pretty, pretty quiet and awkward, Ralph Bernstein of the Associated Press, so I know you remember, asked you the question, Julius, where do you bank?
Is that what he said?
That's what he said. Okay. And your answer was?
That was awfully personal, I think, for a sports question.
You said, I believe that's an unfair question. And we all went, ooh. And,
okay. But I do remember the press conference.
I do.
And I did have a bow tie on.
Okay.
I had a blazer, had a little plaid blazer and a solid crimson-colored bow tie.
Uh-huh.
Making my entry into Philly. Yeah. So.
Well, we remember the afro. The afro was awesome.
Yeah. You know what? It was a lot of pressure to keep that afro in shape.
Well, you
especially
said
when
you're
running and jumping. And, you know,
you said it took great care and maintenance.
It did. It did. Yeah. And I went corporate after that. So.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I'm still corporate.
Why did you write this book?
I think we finished the book maybe around early May. And for the two previous years, we worked on the project, trying to get it right, trying to get it done. This project was started and stopped half dozen to a dozen times in the last 20 years. So I had inquiries and regarding doing a book from age 40 on, and actually visited a couple of different publishing houses. And I don't think it was a matter of getting cold feet when the project stopped. It was just, it didn't have the warm, fuzzy feeling that we eventually got to, you know, after I got past age 59 and started looking back and realizing that, you know, more had happened than was going to happen in life. And I wanted to have personal firsthand say-so in terms of how I'm viewed by my family members, the generations to come of the Irving and Abney families, and the public, you know, public fans, friends, and future curiosity seekers.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to have firsthand say-so and talk in the first person, so the book is completely in the first person.
Right.
I thought I needed to do that before the window closed where, you know, I would, you know, maybe become a non-factor in terms of sports history.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that happens. That happens. I love you guys, too. But it happens. It happens. It don't happen to everyone, but it happens.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a window. I mean, and even if it just got shut down a little bit more from where it is, and ironically, you know, it's bigger than ever, and we're in it, and we're in it to win it.
Yeah. You're remarkably candid in this book. You know, mentioning all your faults, your tragedies, the things that struck you personally. As far as the faults and infidelities, I think there was a threat of destroying most people's image and perception of Dr. J. Was that a worry of yours that, you know, by being so open and honest about your faults, like any human being, that you were going to lose fan support or popularity or anything like that?
Well, I think the subject matter poses a dilemma because, you know, if you put kid gloves on and you try to skate by issues that are real issues in your life, then I think then you lose, people lose respect for you. You know, if I put fluff out there as an autobiography, you know, knowing that, you know, there were a lot of times in which we were between a rock and a hard place and, you know, we made some decisions that we're not proud of, but there were lessons learned upon making those decisions, and I think there are lessons for others to learn in reading about it, you know, particularly if it's, you know, said by somebody who they admire, somebody who's, you know, a model for them, somebody who's their hero, or just somebody who has, you know, a public image. So So the dilemma was resolved by just deciding to, you know, go from my heart, my gut, and be candid. And everything we talk about in the book is fact-based. You know, nothing's made up, nothing's contrived, you know, nothing's gratuitous in terms of putting it there for shock value. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the age of shock reporting.
Yep.
So, you know, it's interesting that some of the issues that I talk about, there are people who have opinions about it and who have comments, and their opinions and comments are shocking. But what I talked about was not necessarily shocking. It was just fact. Mm-hmm. So we have to wrestle with that. But I'm, you know, old enough and I guess experienced enough to meet that stuff head on. Right. That's why I'm sitting here.
Yeah. You lost your dad, your younger brother, Marky, your sister, Freda, at 37, and your son, Corey. Mm-hmm. How tough was that to recount those tragedies in the book?
Probably the most difficult during my lifetime was losing my brother when I was 19 and he was 16. The other ultimate loss was when my mom passed in 2004, right. Because it made me the last surviving member of my immediate family. So that's when you really, you know, feel your mortality, when you know you're there and you look at the siblings gone and, you know, mother, father, stepfather. And, you know, you've come to grips with each situation as it occurs. But there's an emptiness associated with that. And fortunately, you know, I mean, I have a wife, I have beautiful children, and, you know, I have, you know, 4 sons and 3 daughters and 5 grandchildren.
Oh, wow.
So, but they don't all live under the same roof with me. But, you know, that's the salvage part of it. You know, when you lose people, they do get replaced by others that are brought into your life. And, you know, that's part of the wonder of God.
Mm-hmm. One of the fascinating parts of the book is you talk about your youth, organized, neat, everything in its place, not a troublemaker, played by the rules. As you got older, no drugs. What was the genesis of your thoughts regarding, you know, order, neatness, and playing by the rules?
I mean, I've always been success-driven and, you know, never really had a big ego associated with feeding my ego. So the order that I really wanted to have in life was a nice aid in terms of, you know, building a foundation and then trying to go to the next level. Mm-hmm. After you have done the things that are fundamental in life. So if you put time and energy into, you know, trying to be a whole being, trying to physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually be what I term the complete package, mm-hmm. you know, and all of those things are, if they're all 10s on your scale of 1 to 10, you know, then you're the perfect being. And uh-huh. we know they're not going to all be 10s, and they're not going to all be 10s at the same time, but they can all take a ride towards becoming a 10 in your life.
Right.
And so I guess, and I used to kind of play a game with my sister, because she was very talkative, and she was 3 years older than me, and she was, you know, bigger, stronger, faster, or whatever. So I used to kind of neutralize her a little bit by playing the thinking game. And sit back and, you know, she used to always wonder what was on my mind, and I wasn't sharing it. I wasn't sharing it because, you know, she might say it was stupid or whatever. Mm-hmm. But so I just kind of held on to certain things, and I did a lot of thinking. I mean, I was really a thinker as a young person, and after thinking things and when things quieted down and I really didn't let anybody know, I would test it, mm-hmm. you know, and a lot of the things worked.
Yeah.
So, you know, we all have our little idiosyncrasies that are part of, you know, our youth growing up that, you know, still are a part of your life as an adult. So I still like things in order. I like them, you know, lines and columns. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm always going to be that way.
The book mentions when you were starting to be called The Doctor and then Dr. J. Could you share with us the creation of those nicknames?
I would love to. I would love to. The the doctor was born out of playing on the playgrounds and having a buddy who's, you know, still my buddy and, you know, still an argumentative soul. No matter what happened, you know, he always wanted to argue, and to the point where his arguments would turn into lectures. Mm-hmm. So I called him the professor, you know, thinking of a college professor giving lectures. And he reciprocated and called me the doctor. So we just had our nicknames between us, and we went through 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade. We end up going to the same college at UMass, mm-hmm. And now we're neighbors in Atlanta.
Wow.
And he's the professor, and I'm the doctor. But I became Dr. J when I left school after my junior year and turned professional, and I went to training camp, and the trainer called a team physician, doc, mm-hmm. and there was a second doc out there who was the assistant trainer. They called him Doc, so they just couldn't call me Doc, and he started saying, well, you're going to be Dr. J, and the physician's going to be Dr. M, and the other guy's going to be Dr. T, or whatever. So suddenly the doctor became Dr. J, and Virginia Squires promoted me and the guy who was the best player on the team, this guy Charlie Scott, who went to North Carolina. So they used to call him Charlie the Great Scott, and Julius Dr. J. Irving. And that's how Dr. J. was born. All right.
The Rucker League, you reached legend status, and they tried to give you other nicknames, but you said, nah, I'm the doctor.
yeah.
Well, how'd that formulate your career as, you know, the guy we know as Dr. J. on the basketball court, the high-flying, Afro-waving, you know, guy?
Afro wig, did you say?
Waving.
Oh, Afro
no
waving,
wig.
Well, a lot of those out there on Halloween, right? Afro wigs. You know, funny, you know, on the Halloween nights, I mean, I do get texts and pictures of people who put on the Sixers number 6 or the Nets 32, and they always put on a wig and a headband, and I just don't remember wearing a headband. Even when LeBron did that, what Mark was talking about, he had a headband on. I was like, I just don't remember. You know, mine's a terrible thing to waste.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. But
the Rucker
League. The Rucker League. Ironically, I happened to be in college the same time as Lou Alcindor. And in order to neutralize Lou Alcindor, they made a rule, the NCAA made a rule, no dunking. And when he graduated, they put it back in where you could dunk. So, I mean, go figure who it was directed at. So, and they still won the NCAA championship, you know, 3 years.
His three
sophomore, junior and senior years. So they tried to neutralize him and they couldn't. But what they did, what others who were in college, and I was 2 years behind them, was, you know, took one of my favorite shots out of the game because, you know, I was a pretty good dunker.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really develop a sky hook or anything, but I did develop getting above the rim and, you know, land the ball in. And I felt the sophomore year and junior year in college was in part a time in which I stored up a lot of dunk anxiety, you know, because I couldn't dunk the ball. And I was like, and even in the first year, they let you dunk in the warm-ups. And the second, you couldn't even dunk in the warm-ups. So I was like, man, I got all these shots, and I can't show them to nobody, right? So when I got to the Rucker League, which was prior to my pro career, somebody was going to catch it, you know. And as it turned out, you know, there was some extra sauce
right.
put on a lot of the shots, and it quickly established me in terms of having a reputation as right. high flyer and attacker of the basket, and it felt good, and I got a lot of confidence mm-hmm. from playing in the summer pro league up in Harlem, you know, because people were like this. I mean, they were this close to you, sitting on the right on the lines of the court, feet on the court. People were on buildings, people were on trees, people were on train station stops. And, you know, it was free basketball, free pro basketball in the summer. So I did that for 5 years, for five seasons. Mm-hmm. And it was always kind of a tune-up and a challenge to do more than you did the previous year. And it wasn't great for the knees.
No.
But I gave the Harlem Pro League 5 years, mm-hmm. and they gave me a lifetime of appreciation.
Yeah, yeah. You always mentioned that you were shy around girls, awkward around girls. Talk about from the time you started discovering girls to the time you met Turquoise.
Whew.
It's in the book.
Let's see.
Next question.
Well, we met at 22.
Okay.
And we were married at 23.
Okay.
So it was a one-year courtship.
Okay.
And in those first 22 years, yeah, I was...
Well, I just wanted to read one quote, if you'll excuse me.
Okay.
Together you became the JFK and the Jackie of African-American and cool.
There you go. Yeah, I think there was, you know, the dynamic of us as a couple. There was a four kids, for one thing. And there was a certain cool and a certain swag associated with us, the way we dressed and the way we moved about, particularly after we moved from Long Island to Philadelphia. And we established ourselves in this community as community patrons and leaders in the community. And we had a very good run.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very good run. I mean, you know, we were married for 30 years. So, you know, that's nothing you shake a stick at.
No.
And, you know, there were challenges during that time. But it's on the record. And mm-hmm. it's in my heart and in her heart.
You started making big money when you joined the New York Nets in the ABA. And you said in the book you gave away $6 million to $10 million over the years and never once got a penny of that repaid.
I got some of it repaid.
What was the reason for the generosity?
Well, I've never been a selfish individual. And I went to Roosevelt Junior Senior High School, and I never really learned about economics there. One of the things in life that happens with young athletes is you're pretty much ill prepared for overnight success, and I was guilty of that. So I was very trusting of agents and managers and lawyers and accountants and, you know, people who were brought into my life. And you know, of course, the conversation was, you have to have these people. These are the people who are going to show you how to deal with your earnings. And the reality is, if you're the first generation at something, there's a price that you're going to pay.
Mm.
And we were certainly, and I was certainly first generation of high income earners in my family.
Mm-hmm.
There have been others after me, you know, who have fared better, and but you know, the monies that have gone one way and never come back, you know, they probably represent about 20% of, you know, what I've been able to generate in my life, and I'm still productive. So, you know, I have this philosophy about you know, health and productivity and happiness. If you can get all three of those, you know, as part of your personal package, because they work in sync with one another.
Yeah.
And generally, an unhealthy person is unproductive and not happy. You know, and if you just have two of them, you got to fight to get that third one. So that's the package I strive for as well. You know, I have all these little packages. Yeah. And when you talk to people, you know, share the package. But, you know, health and productivity and happiness all go together.
October 25th, 1976, you were uprooted from the New York Nets and came to Philadelphia. What was it like to play in front of what you could say were success-starved fans?
Well, I know one thing. I was knee-deep in a tremendous rivalry with Boston.
Yep.
When I moved to Philly. And you know, when I was in New York, I had no idea the rivalry was so deep, the entrenched, and so personal. So I only had one choice, hate Boston. And we had our battles. You know, there were times in which they got the better of us, but, you know, we got the better of them plenty of times, and it was always, you know, it was always an extra joyous occasion to go into Boston and win in the Boston Garden. And, you know, and I know our fans enjoyed it. And you know, it was, suddenly it made sports like life or death. Mm-hmm. And we know it's not, but it certainly seemed like that, you know, some nights. And you were there, and so many people who were in the room were there. I mean, it's so easy to hate those guys, man, you know, because they play dirty. You know? Yeah, I mean, there's no knocking them down and helping them up after that. When you knock them down, let the teammate help them up. Yeah. You know, with other teams, you know, you might help somebody up or dust them off a little bit or whatever. Not with Boston. It's just like, man, if he's on the ground, let him stay there.
Well, you brought it up, Larry Bird. Sorry.
You know, the funny part about that, I mean, we'd do Converse commercials together, right. Spalding commercials together, Electronic Arts commercials together, and over those years that we overlapped. And I'm 9 years ahead of him, so he came in, I was already a 9-year veteran mm-hmm. when he came in, so a lot of people say it was this, you know, big rivalry, he was the main guy, but, you know, it's... You know, he's a baby coming in. His first year was my 10th year. The Boston-Philly rivalry was there, and then he became, you know, the focal point of Boston following John Havlicek and sure. JoJo White and Dave Cowens. And they were more my contemporaries. But the Bird-Irving rivalry, you know, escalated one night into some fisticuffs. You know, I look back on it. I mean, I'm never proud of fighting on a basketball court because I had a high school coach. He said, you know, you never accomplish anything when you fight. We have an enforcer over here. That's his job, not your job. You're the star of the team. Don't be stupid, you know. But I look back on that one and, you know, the way it's viewed now since it's so far in the rearview mirror is I'm kind of glad it happened. Got a couple shots in, you know.
Well, you said, I don't hate Larry Bird. I hate the Celtics. That's
there you go.
Quote.
There you go.
1983, the championship. The parade.
Yeah.
What? You had a great quote. You said, I didn't drink any champagne in the locker room. I wanted to be 100% aware of what was going on around me. What was it all like?
Yeah. The previous championships that I had experienced were in the ABA and they were with the Nets, the New York Nets, and it was in 74 and 76. And, you know, the memory is really faded because I drank a lot of champagne and poured a lot of champagne on people or whatever. And then now, the next 7 years, you know, we're the runner-up team 3 different times. So we're getting to the big dance, but we're not getting over the hump. And it's the same thing. The window, you know, your windows in sports, you know, they open, they have a time period, and then they close. And you can never take for granted. And so when you feel like you've blown a potential opportunity, and at least one of those 3 times, I mean, I feel like we blew it. Probably the first time when we had Coach Hsu. And they had Jack Ramsey. And Jack basically won his only championship
right.
against us. So they always talk about, you know, how great a coach he is, and he's the godfather of basketball. He won one championship, you know, which was when they knocked us off by winning those 4 straight games in that year in 76. And that one could have been ours because we were up 2-0.
Right.
And I think we got out-coached, and obviously we got outplayed on the court. But I think we were a better team. And 5 games into the next season, the whole idea of redeeming yourself gets thrown out the window because Coach Chu gets fired. And then we start, you know, trading players, George McGinnis and so on and so forth. So the team never got a chance to redeem itself. And that team could have won multiple championships, I think. Mm-hmm. I think so. But you never had a chance to do it.
Right. And 83, obviously, you brought in Moses Malone, and you guys had hit it off right away.
Yeah. Yeah, the Moses Malone deal, there are other franchises who make comparisons, but there's very few franchises who have had, you know, who can get the most valuable player in the league and have the two previous most, because I was the most valuable player in 1981.
That's right.
He's the most valuable player in 1982 and in 83. So now we have on the same team the guys who were deemed to be most valuable players in the league, you know, three successive years. And you know, that was pretty special. And it was no problem deferring to Moses and his style of play, because, you know, his style of play was a lot of what I was accustomed to when I would just play on the playgrounds in New York and, you know, around the basket, you know, getting the garbage and putting it back up and keep throwing it up there until it goes in. And he just had this relentlessness about him. And he didn't, you know, like some guys who are big, you know, they like to go outside, shoot three-pointers, and, you know, they like to handle the ball, and they do all that. You know, I mean, this was a man with blue collar,
right,
and a construction helmet on. He said, "I'm doing my work in the paint." And, you know, we even had a little joke. We said, "Well, we throw it in the mold, we know it's not coming back out." Like throwing it into a black hole right there. But he knows what to do with it, though.
Right.
So he was great. And, you know, we got the monkey off our back in 83 and, you know, gave the city that championship and gave ourselves the championship. So we did it as much for ourselves as we did for the city. And it stands as one of the best runs that any team in the history of the league has ever had, you know, with the 12-1 record in the playoffs.
Right. 1986-87 was your last season. It was kind of like a farewell tour.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? You got a rocking chair, and you got all kind of gifts. You even got cheered in Boston.
I even got cheered in Boston. You know, and they had a red six up in the stands, just clearly. I can remember it like it was yesterday. And Red Auerbach comes out and he presents me with a piece of the parquet floor, and he gives me a clock that says, "Time marches on, but memories are forever." And I say, "Well, there's some decency here after all." But they know I'm leaving. But, you know, I always had a little bit of a following up there from going to UMass and from being educated in Massachusetts. So it wasn't nearly as bad as the media wrote about. Oh, that's you. I'm sorry.
Right. Sorry.
Yeah. So that farewell tour, though, they've had farewell tours before and after.
Right.
And, you know, Michael Jordan had a farewell tour, Kareem. And I remember John Havlicek's more so than I remember the latter twos. But I don't think there was ever one like mine,
mm-hmm.
You know. And that's a story unto itself, because the tour was set up, but nobody knew that I would break a finger that year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even remember
so
that.
So we played the Knicks, and I end up getting a hairline fracture in my index finger. So I had a cast on, and I missed 20-some-odd games.
Oh, wow.
So now we're going on this farewell tour, and I'm not even playing. I'm just going and making a little speech before the game and then going to sit on the bench and talking to the fans. So I ended up, playing less games that year than any time. I think I played maybe like 60 games, missed 22. But I really got a chance to soak it in because I was in a suit and tie for a third of the season. Yeah.
But it was a nice suit and tie, I'll bet.
Thank you.
That's really the end of this segment where I ask questions, but we're going to do audience questions for about 10 minutes, and then Doc will start writing books. The gentleman in the Sixer jersey, you're leading off.
Hey, Doc. It's good seeing you. God bless you.
Thank you.
I got a question. My favorite dunk of all time is the one you did on Michael Cooper. Uh-huh. I love that dunk very much. Awesome.
Yeah.
The thing that made it awesome, though, is that you palmed it off the dribble, which I never saw that before. Now, I was wondering, have you ever, how long did it take you to perfect that in your time? And I also want to talk about, like, Billy Cunningham. Did you see him in the Rucker during your time, and how good a player was he when you saw him?
Well, I mean, Billy's in the Hall of Fame as a player and as a coach, so I'll answer the question in reverse. So he's one of the best forwards, you know, ever to play. He was called a kangaroo kid because he could jump out the gym. He was a lefty, so he was really hard to defend. And he was a Brooklyn guy, so he never backed down from anybody, you know. And he brought the same thing to coaching. In terms of that cup move, I think I used to watch Connie Hawkins, you know, pick it up off the dribble. And he just was like the galloping gourmet, you know. He was just smooth and silky, and he'd do things with one hand with the ball. And that particular play, it wasn't planned. I think, you know, I stole the ball, and I'm going down the left sideline, and here comes Cooper running full speed, you know. And I know he's a shot blocker. He's a great defensive player. You know, he's all defensive team his whole career. So I didn't really know what I was going to do, you know. And then it was just like, you know, Grover Washington Jr. playing. You know, it was like like a little rhythm, and the ball got cupped. And, you know, it was like, we're going to see what's going to happen. So it got cupped. I went up, and I had it back. And I'm watching him. He's watching me. I'm watching him. He's watching me. And then he kind of sees the rim out of the corner of his eye, and he ducks. And that was like the cue. When he ducked, you know, I came in with the slam, and he got posterized.
All right, gentlemen over there with the hat.
Thank you so much, Dr. J, for everything you've done for us.
All right.
Is there a backstory to the homage that Grover Washington penned for you?
Is there a backstory?
Yeah.
Yes, you know, Grover used to show up for all of our big games. He was at all of our games, but he would only play, you know, for the big games, Celtics and Lakers, you know, Knicks. And there was a game, and he was just watching me this game. And when he left, he went home, and he pinned Let It Flow for Dr. J. And he called me. And he said, I want you to listen to this. So, you know, I listened to it. And, of course, when you listen to new music, you know, it's hard to make out, but it was rhythmic and it flows and it just had, you know, high notes and then come back down. And it really seemed like, you know, some of the things that you would see in a game, in a fast-paced game, you know, when you got high flyers and you got good plays made. So, you know, I mean, nobody knew. It was part of the Wine Light album, and it was a platinum album, and it was a great tribute. Let it flow.
And the greatest national anthem you ever heard. A young man in the Sixer jersey.
All right.
Did you ever dunk on Michael Jordan, and what are your top three players of all time?
Wow.
Okay. Well, you know, Michael came into the league, and he was a highly touted rookie. And what ended up happening the first time he came to Philadelphia, he actually dunked on me. And the next play, I went down the court and dunked on him. And it was like back-to-back plays, and I think he scored like 31 points in the game, though. So I was like, we're going to have to contend with this guy. But what was the other part of the question?
Top three players of all time.
Top three players. You know, I'm going to disappoint a lot of people. Not everybody, because, you know, a Philly player is on the team. But I made a decision when I was about his age that this is my all-time team. So in watching basketball, I made that decision, and it was one of those things where you get kind of entrapped because, you know, players come and go, but they couldn't crack my starting five. You know, so my starting five is Wilt Chamberlain, Bill Russell, Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, and Oscar Robertson. Now, I'll put that team on the court against anybody. Anybody. And you don't even know who all those guys are, do you? You do? All right. All right. My man.
The gentleman over here, stage left.
Yeah, Dr. J, at any time in your storied legendary career, do you ever miss playing for the Milwaukee Bucks? And if you miss them, what do you think of the organization today here in 2013 compared to when you were drafted by them out of Roosevelt Long Island Junior Senior High School? And I'm from Huntington, by the way. And that was my man Arnold in the corner over there.
Okay. All right. You're going to have to read the book because you got to get your story straight, too.
All right.
I found myself at one time under a signed contract with the Virginia Squires, signed contract with the Atlanta Hawks, drafted by the Milwaukee Bucks, and pursued by the New York Nets. So I had four teams that were vying for my service at the same time. And the commissioner of the league and a mediator and the courts ruled in favor of Milwaukee. But my agent didn't want me to go there and play in Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's shadow. And he was pulling for New York. So New York came in and basically bought out the contracts. And that's how I ended up playing for the Nets. So the story is chronicled in the book. And it's an interesting story about, you know, moving from amateur sports to professional sports. And when in Rome, kind of, you know, doing what the Romans do. Because it was a very perplexing time for me. And the solution for it was, you know, going back to the place where I was born and raised and playing there, even though I wanted to be an Atlanta Hawk. And that never happened.
The gentleman to our right, Julius.
Hey, hey, Dr. J.
How you doing?
You're my all-time favorite athlete.
Thank you.
So thank you for taking my question.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Two questions for you. One was, you know, Philly obviously is an incredibly passionate sports town. Was there a moment when you walked on the court at the Spectrum or maybe in a press conference where it made sense? You're like, I totally get it. I feel it. That's my first question. My second question would be if you could be a teammate, if you could choose anyone, past or present, to be as a teammate, who would that be?
Yeah. There were a lot of moments in Philadelphia. And in 83, when we won the first two games in Philly, and we got up 2-0 again, you know, like it was with Portland, there was a different feeling than against Portland because there was still uncertainty and with the makeup of that other team. But with this team, and Moses and Cheeks and Tony and Ivoroni and Bobby Jones. And, you know, we just had a cast of guys who were real professionals and really believed in themselves and believed that it was our time. So those moments during that sweep against the Lakers, there was this special feeling of oneness. And it became even more so after the sweep was done and, you know, the brooms came out. And the city got united. The city got united because, I mean, there was a lot of tension in Philly during that time in terms of race relations and, you know, the election, the political environment. But I think when the Sixers brought the championship home, Philly came together. And Philly really came together like never before. And what was the other part of your question? The two players or the teammates? Teammates. I had tremendous teammates. If I were going to name one, you know, I'd have to say my best relationship was with Steve Mix. You know, Steve was, we were teammates for 8 seasons, and we roomed together on the roads. A lot of guys had single rooms, and Steve and I always roomed together. You know, his daughter is my goddaughter. And you know, I mean, we're friends for life, and that was cemented by, you know, me basically coming to Philadelphia and taking his job, you know, because Steve was an all-star in the league 1 year, and it was when the league had to have one representative from every team, and he was the guy who was an all-star at our position. So, you know, Billy came back from Carolina and took his job. And then Billy got hurt. Then I came in and took his job. And he just, you know, he just stayed the course. I mean, he was a guy who was gracious to be in the league. He had been cut by 9 different teams trying to get into the league, and he landed the job in Philadelphia. And the other irony is he was my teammate up until the time, you know, we got Moses Malone and we won the championship. He ended up being on the Lakers when we won the championship for the Sixers. So it was kind of a sad irony, but he's the guy. He was my.
And we have a young man in the center here.
Thank you.
All right.
What made you passionate about playing basketball, and who taught you how to do the behind the court layup?
Okay, kind of like the under the backboard layup, huh? Yeah, the passion came from realizing it was something that I could do very well, and I didn't know that probably till I was maybe around 20 that that basketball was going to be my career. I thought before, I always looked at it as being a student athlete, you know, in high school and college, just as being a student athlete, that I needed to be a student and I needed to prepare to go to work when basketball was done. And the idea of being a pro, there was no certainty. You know, you don't choose to be a pro, pros choose you. So after my sophomore year, that's when I, you know, started talking to the different people, and I went out to training camp for the Olympic team and the 72 Olympic team, and made the team, and I was the leading scorer and rebounder and the pre-Olympic team. So I realized that, you know, I guess I was pretty good, and there was a chance of me having a professional career. But I didn't even think in that way until I was about 20. And the passion was always there, particularly after I stopped playing other sports and just played basketball versus baseball and football and, you know, the other sports. And, you know, I guess I guessed right, and I still feel that basketball chose me, that I didn't really choose it. The arrows lined up, and I got chosen by it. Thank you.
The book is called Dr. J, An Autobiography. We'd like to thank Julius Erving, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.